Disc 3. Islam continued to spread rapidly throughout the clans of Aus and Khazraj, and some believers looked forward to the day when, thanks to the covenant with the Jews, the oasis would be one harmonious whole. But the revelation now gave warning of hidden elements of discord. It was about this time that the longest surah of the Quran began to be revealed, Al-Baqarah, the heifer, which is placed at the beginning of the book, immediately after the seven verses of Al-Fatiha, the opening. It starts with a definition of the rightly guided, Alif Lam Mim. This, beyond doubt, is the book, a guidance unto the God-fearing, who believe in the unseen and perform the prayer and give of that which we have bestowed upon them, and who believe in that which is revealed unto thee, and in that which was revealed before thee, and who are certain of the hereafter. These are they who follow guidance from their Lord, and these are they who shall prosper. Then, after mention of the disbelievers who are blind and deaf to the truth, a third body of people is mentioned. And of men there are some who say, "We believe in God and in the last day," yet they are not believers. When they meet those who believe, they say, "We believe," and when they go apart unto their Satans, they say, "Verily we are with you, we did but mock." These were the waverers and doubters and hypocrites of Aus and Khazraj, in all their varying degrees of insincerity. And their Satans, that is, their inspirers of evil, were the men and women of the disbelievers who did all they could to sow the seeds of doubt. The prophet was here warned of a problem by which he had been altogether untroubled in Mecca. There the sincerity of those who embraced Islam was never to be doubted. The reasons for conversion could only be spiritual, since as regards the things of this world, a convert had nothing to gain and in many cases much to lose. But now there were certain worldly reasons for entering the new religion, and these were steadily on the increase. The days of the total absence of hypocrites from the ranks of the Muslims were gone forever. Among the chief adversaries to Islam was Abdullah ibn Ubay, who also felt himself to have been frustrated by the coming of the Prophet and robbed not of spiritual authority but of the chief temporal power in the Yathrib oasis. But he soon saw that his influence, once so great, was rapidly dwindling, and that if he did not enter Islam, it would vanish altogether. On the other hand, he knew that a nominal acceptance of Islam would confirm him in his authority, for the Arabs were averse to breaking their old ties of allegiance unless there was a great reason for doing so. It was therefore not long before he decided to enter Islam. But although he formally pledged himself to the Prophet and regularly thereafter attended the prayers, the believers never came to feel sure of him. There were others about whom they were equally doubtful, but Ibn Ubay was different from the majority of lukewarm or insincere converts by reason of his far-reaching influence, which made him all the more dangerous. Islam was now firmly established in the oasis. The revelation prescribed the giving of alms and the fast of the month of Ramadan, and laid down in general what was forbidden and what was allowed. The five daily ritual prayers were regularly performed in congregation, and when the time for each prayer came, the people would assemble at the site where the mosque was being built. Everyone judged of the time by the position of the sun in the sky, or by the first signs of its light on the eastern horizon, or by the dimming of its glow in the west after sunset. But opinions could differ, and the Prophet felt the need for a means of summoning the people to prayer when the right time had come. At first he thought of appointing a man to blow a horn, like that of the Jews, but later he decided on a wooden clapper, nakus, such as the Oriental Christians used at that time, and two pieces of wood were fashioned together for that purpose. But they were never destined to be used. For one night a man of Khazraj, Abdullah ibn Zayd, who had been at the second Aqaba, had a dream which the next day he recounted to the Prophet. "There passed by me a man wearing two green garments, and he carried in his hand a nakus. So I said unto him, O slave of God, wilt thou sell me that nakus? What wilt thou do with it? He said. We will summon the people to prayer with it, I answered. Shall I not show thee a better way? He said. What way is that? I asked. And he answered, that thou shouldst say, God is most great, Allahu Akbar. The man in green repeated this magnification four times, then each of the following twice. I testify that there is no God but God. I testify that Muhammad is the messenger of God. Come unto the prayer, come unto salvation. God is most great. And then once again, there is no God but God. The Prophet said that this was a true vision, and he told him to go to Bilal, who had an excellent voice, and teach him the words exactly as he had heard them in his sleep. The highest house in the neighbourhood of the mosque belonged to a woman of the clan of Najjar, and Bilal would come there before every dawn and would sit on the roof waiting for the daybreak. When he saw the first faint light in the east, he would stretch out his arms and say in supplication, O God, I praise thee, and I ask thy help for Quraysh, that they may accept thy religion. Then he would stand and utter the call to prayer. When the mosque was nearly finished, the Prophet gave orders for two small dwellings to be attached to its eastern wall, one for his wife Sauda, and the other for his betrothed Aisha. The building had taken altogether 7 months. The Prophet and his daughters now went to live with Sauda in her new house, and after a month or two it was decided that Aisha's wedding should take place. She was then only 9 years old, and a child of remarkable beauty. To Aisha, the Prophet had long been very near and very dear, and she had been accustomed to see him every day, except during those few months when he and her father had already emigrated and she and her mother were still in Mecca. From her earliest years, she had seen her father and mother treat him with such love and reverence as they gave no one else. Nor had they failed to impress upon her the reasons for this. She knew well that he was the messenger of God, that he had regular converse with the angel Gabriel, and that he was unique amongst living men in that he had ascended to heaven and returned from thence to earth. His very presence told of that ascent, and communicated something of the joy of paradise. In his miraculous touch, this joy was even tangible. When others were overcome by the heat, his hand would be cooler than snow and more fragrant than musk. He seemed, moreover, ageless, like an immortal. His eyes had lost nothing of their lustre, his black hair and beard had still the sheen of youth, and his body had the grace of a man whose age was only half of his 53 years. Small preparations were made for the wedding. Not enough, at any rate, for Aisha to have had the sense of a great and solemn occasion, and shortly before they were due to leave the house, she had slipped out into the courtyard to play with a passing friend. In her own words, I was playing on a seesaw, and my long streaming hair was dishevelled. They came and took me from my play and made me ready. Abu Bakr had bought some fine red-striped cloth from Bahrain, and it had been made into a wedding dress for her. In this they now clothed her. Then her mother took her to the newly built house, where some women of the helpers were waiting for her outside the door. They greeted her with the words, For good and for happiness, may all be well, and led her into the presence of the Prophet. He stood there smiling while they combed her hair and decked her with ornaments. Unlike his other marriages, at this there was no wedding feast. The occasion was as simple as possible. A bowl of milk was brought, and having drunk from it himself, he offered it to her. She shyly declined it, but when he pressed her to drink, she did so, and offered the bowl to her sister, Asma, who was sitting beside her. Others also drank of it. Then they all went their ways, and the bridegroom and bride were left together. Unto those who are attacked, permission to fight is given unto those who fight because they have been wronged, and God is able to give them victory. Those who have been driven from their homes unjustly, for no cause other than for their saying, Our Lord is God. The prophet had received this revelation not long after his arrival in Medina. He knew, moreover, that permission was here a command, and the obligations of war had been stressed in the covenant with the Jews. An early revelation had said, Deal gently with the disbelievers, give them respite for a while. But the last three words were portentous, and now God had declared war on Quraysh. His messenger was therefore obliged to attack them by every means in his power, and to make it clear to them that Arabia would never be safe for them until they submitted to the divine will. Nor was he unaware that to give Quraysh no peace meant giving himself and his companions no peace. This premonition was soon to be confirmed by another revelation. Fight them until persecution is no more, and religion is all for God. But for the moment there could be no question of anything but raids. Quraysh were vulnerable in their caravans, and it was especially in the spring and early summer months, when their trade with Syria was most active, that they lay open to attack from Medina. The information received in Medina about the caravans was seldom very precise, and there were liable to be last-minute changes of plan. Thus they missed a rich caravan which the Shamsite Abu Sufyan was conducting to Syria. News of it had come too late, and when the Prophet and his men reached Ushaira in the valley of Yanbu, which opens out onto the Red Sea southwest of Medina, the caravan had already passed. But Abu Sufyan would soon be returning from Syria, perhaps with an even richer load, and then, if God willed, they would not fail to waylay him. It was at this time that there came a revelation of great ritual importance. Its opening words refer to the Prophet's extreme care to face in the right direction for prayer. In the mosque, the direction was set by the mihrab, the prayer niche in the Jerusalem wall. But when he was outside the town, he would check his direction by the sun if it were day and by the stars at night. We have seen the turning of thy face unto the sky, and now we shall turn thee away that shall well please thee. So turn thou thy face towards the inviolable mosque, and wheresoever ye may be, turn ye your faces toward it. A mihrab was forthwith made in the south wall of the mosque, facing towards Mecca, and the change was accepted with joy by the Prophet and his companions. From that day, Muslims have turned in the direction of the Kaaba for the performance of the ritual prayer, and by extension for other rites. When the time was at hand for Abu Sufyan to return with all the wares that he and his fellows had acquired in Syria, the Prophet sent two scouts to Hawra on the seashore due west of Medina to bring him news as soon as the caravan arrived. This would enable him, by a quick march to the southwest, to overtake it further down the coast. But someone in Medina, no doubt one of the hypocrites or one of the Jews, had already sent word of the Prophet's plans to Abu Sufyan, who immediately hired a man of the Gifari tribe, Damdam by name, to go with all speed to Mecca and urge Quraysh to march out at once with an army to their rescue, while he himself pressed forward along the coastal route, travelling by both day and night. But his was not the only sense of urgency. Rather than risk being too late, the Prophet decided not even to wait for the return of his scouts. By the time they reached Medina, he had already set out with an army of emigrants and helpers, 305 men altogether. Meanwhile, Damdam had arrived in the valley outside Mecca. The people streamed out of their houses and out of the mosque to where he had halted. Abu Sufyan had paid him handsomely, and he was determined to play his part well. He had turned round his saddle and was seated with his back to his camel's head, and in further sign of calamity he had slit his camel's nose so that the blood poured forth from it, and he had rent his own shirt to ribbons. "Men of Quraysh," he shouted, "the transport camels, the transport camels, your goods which are with Abu Sufyan, Muhammad and his companions are upon them. Help! Help!" The town was immediately in an uproar. The caravan, now in danger, was one of the richest of the year, and many were those who had reason to fear the loss of it. An army of about 1,000 men was quickly mustered. The Prophet had by now left the direct route from Medina to the south and was making for Badr, which lay on the coastal road from Syria to Mecca, to his west. It was at Badr that he hoped to waylay Abu Sufyan. Then came the news that Quraysh had set out with an army to rescue their caravan. This had always been considered as a possibility, but now that it had become a fact, the certainty came to the Prophet that they would indeed have to contend with either the army or the caravan, but not with both. "Onwards," he said, "and be of good cheer, for God the All-Highest hath promised me one of the two parties, and even now it is as if I saw the enemy lying prostrate." It was not long before news of the 1,000-strong army reached Abu Sufyan, and by that time he had reached a point from which his rescuers were between him and the enemy. Realizing that the caravan was now safe, he sent a messenger to Quraysh, saying, "Ye came out to defend your camels and your men and your goods, and God hath rescued them, therefore return." When Abu Jahl was told of this, he addressed the army. "By God, we will not return until we have been at Badr. 3 days will we stay there. We will slaughter camels and feast and make flow the wine, and the songstresses shall play and sing for us. And the Arabs will hear how we marched forth and of our mighty gathering, and they will stand in awe of us for ever. Onwards to Badr." Beyond the hill, a little to the northeast, the Muslims were breaking camp. The Prophet knew that it was imperative for them to reach the waters of Badr before the enemy, so he ordered an immediate advance. That night, God sent down a peaceful sleep upon the believers, and they awoke refreshed. It was Friday, the 17th of March, A.D. 623, which was the 17th of Ramadan in the year AH2, the second year after the Hijrah, the beginning of the Islamic era. As soon as it was dawn, Quraysh marched forth and climbed the hill of Akankal on the opposite side of the valley from Badr. The sun was already up when they reached the top, and when the Prophet saw them on their richly caparisoned horses and camels descending the slope into the valley of Yalyal towards Badr, he prayed, "O God, hear our Quraysh. They have come in their arrogance and their vanity, opposing thee and belying thy messenger. O Lord, grant us thy help, which thou didst promise us. O Lord, this morn destroy them." Seen across the undulating dunes, the Meccan army appeared to be much smaller than it was. But the Prophet was fully aware of their true numbers and of the great disparity between the two hosts, and he now returned to his shelter with Abu Bakr and prayed for the help which God had promised him. A light slumber came upon him, and when he woke he said, "Be of good cheer, Abu Bakr. The help of God hath come to thee. Here is Gabriel, and in his hand is the rein of a horse which he is leading, and he is armed for war." In the history of the Arabs, many a battle had been averted at the last minute, even when two forces were drawn up face to face. But the Prophet was now certain that the battle would take place, and that this formidable array was the one of the two parties that he had been promised. The vultures also knew that carnage was now imminent, and they were already in wait to feed on the carcasses of the slain, some wheeling overhead, and others perched on the rocky slopes in the rear of either army. The Prophet now exhorted his men, saying, "By him in whose hand is the soul of Muhammad, no man will be slain this day, fighting against them in steadfast hope of his reward, advancing, not retreating, but God shall straightway enter him into paradise." He then took up a handful of pebbles, and shouting at Quraysh, "Defaced be those faces," he hurled the pebbles at them, conscious that he was hurling disaster. Then he gave the order to charge. The battle cry he had devised for them, "Ya Mansur Amit," which means, "O thou whom God hath made victorious, slay," resounded from every throat as the men surged forward. They did not charge alone, as well the prophet knew, for he had been promised, I will help you with 1,000 of the angels, troop on troop. And the angels also had received a divine message. When thy Lord revealed unto the angels, Lo, I am with you, so make firm the believers. I shall cast terror into the hearts of the disbelievers. It is for you to strike off their heads and to smite their every finger. The presence of the angels was felt by all, as a strength by the faithful and as a terror by the infidels. But that presence was only visible or audible to a few, and in varying degrees. 2 men of a neighboring Arab tribe had gone to the top of a hill to see the issue and to take part, so they hoped, in the looting after the battle. A cloud swept by them, a cloud filled with the neighing of stallions, and one of the men dropped instantly dead. His heart burst with fright, said the one who lived to tell of it, judging from what his own heart had felt. One of the believers was pursuing a man of the enemy, and the man's head flew from his body before he could reach him, struck off by an unseen hand. Others had brief glimpses of the angels riding on horses whose hooves never touched the ground, led by Gabriel wearing a yellow turban, whereas the turbans of the other angels were white, with one end left streaming behind them. Quraysh was soon utterly routed and put to flight. Most escaped, but some 50 were mortally wounded or killed outright in the battle, or overtaken and cut down as they fled. About the same number were taken captive. Most of the Prophet's army were in any case bent on holding their captives to ransom, rather than putting them to the sword. There was, however, one man, Abu Jahl, who clearly could not be allowed to live. The general opinion was that he had been killed, and the Prophet gave orders that his body should be searched for. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud went out again to the battlefield and searched until he found the man who had done more than any other to stir up hatred of Islam amongst the people of Mecca. Abu Jahl still had enough life in him to recognize the enemy who now stood over him. Abdullah had been the first man to recite the Quran aloud in front of the Kaaba, and Abu Jahl had struck him a severe blow and wounded him in the face, for he was merely a confederate of Zura, and a poor one at that, his mother having been a slave. Abdullah now placed his foot on the neck of Abu Jahl, who said, Thou hast climbed high indeed, little shepherd. Then he asked him which way the fortunes of war had swung that day, his implication being that next time they would swing in the opposite direction. God and his messenger have won, he answered. Then he cut off his head and took it to the Prophet. As soon as it became clear that the 800 or more Meccan troops still at large had been routed beyond possibility of rallying, the Prophet sent Abdullah ibn Rawaha to take the good tidings of victory to the people of Upper Medina, that is, the more southerly part of the city, and he sent Zayd to the people of Lower Medina. He himself remained with the army at Badr until early the next morning, when he set off for Medina with his army and the spoils. The army of Quraysh made its way back to Mecca in small groups, preceded or followed by single individuals. One of the first to arrive with the news was the Hashemite Abu Sufyan, whose brother Naufal had been captured. Abu Sufyan's hostility towards the new religion had spurred him to write verses against it and against his cousin and foster brother, the Prophet. But the experience of Badr had greatly shaken him. His first thought was to visit the Kaaba, and it happened that his uncle, Abu Lahab, was sitting in the large tent that was known as the Tent of Zamzam. Seeing his nephew, Abu Lahab called out to him to come and sit with him and tell him what had happened. There is no more to it than this, said Abu Sufyan. We met the enemy and turned our backs, and they drove us in flight or took captives even as they pleased. Nor can I blame any of our folk, for we had to face not only them, but also men in white on piebald horses between heaven and earth, who spared nothing, and nothing could stand up against them. Now Umm al-Fadl was sitting in a corner of the tent, and with her was Abu Rafi, one of Abbas's slaves, who was making arrows. Like her, he was a Muslim, and they had both kept their Islam secret from all save a few. But Abu Rafi could not contain himself for joy at the news of the Prophet's victory, and when he heard speak of the men in white between heaven and earth, he exclaimed in wonder and in triumph, "Those were the angels!" Immediately Abu Lahab was overcome by a paroxysm of rage, and he struck Abu Rafi a wounding blow in the face. The slave tried to retaliate, but he was slight and weak, and the thick-set, ponderous Abu Lahab bore him to the ground, knelt on him, and struck him again and again. Then al-Fadl took up a wooden post, which was sometimes used to reinforce the tent poles, and she brought it down with all her strength on the head of her brother-in-law, splitting the skin and flesh away from his skull in a long gash that was never to heal. "Wilt thou treat him as of no account?" she cried, "now that his master is away and cannot protect him?" The wound putrefied, and within a week his whole body was covered with festering pustules, from which he died. When further news of the battle was brought, and the bereaved began to bewail their dead, a decision was quickly made in the assembly that they should be told to restrain themselves. "Muhammad and his companions," it was said to them, "will have news of this and rejoice." As to the kinsmen of the captives, they were urged to delay sending any offers of ransom to Yathrib. Through the deaths of so many eminent men, the Umayyad Abu Sufyan had become, in the eyes of many, the leading man of Quraysh. And as if to set an example, he said with regard to his two sons, Hanzalah and Amr, the one killed and the other made captive, "Must I suffer the twofold loss of my blood and my wealth? They have slain Hanzalah, and must I now ransom Amr? Leave him with them. Let them keep him as long as they please." Abu Sufyan's fiery wife, Hind, was not the mother of either Hanzalah or Amr, but at the outset of the battle she had lost her father, Utbah, her uncle Sheba, and her brother Walid. And though she held back her lamentations, she vowed that when Quraysh took their revenge on the Muslim army, as take it they must, she would eat raw the liver of Hamza, who had slain her uncle and given her father the death blow. As to the rich caravan load which Abu Sufyan had brought safely to Mecca, it was unanimously agreed in the assembly that all the profits should be devoted to raising an army so large and so powerfully equipped that it could not fail to crush any resistance that Yathrib might be able to put up against it. And this time women would march out with the men, to urge them on and spur them to excel themselves in deeds of valour. It was also agreed, to the same purpose, to send messengers to all their many allies throughout Arabia, summoning them to join in their attack, and giving them what they thought to be powerful reasons why the followers of the new religion should be considered as a common enemy. Part of one of the long colonnades in the mosque was now reserved for those newcomers who had nowhere to live and no means of sustenance. They were known as the people of the bench, Ahl as-Sufa, on account of a stone bench which had been placed there for their benefit. And since the mosque was a prolongation of the Prophet's own dwelling, he and his household felt especially responsible for this growing number of impoverished refugees who lived at their very door, whose plight they witnessed daily, and who came in ones and twos from all directions, drawn by the message of Islam and the reports of him and his community, which had by now reached the tribes all over Arabia. The news of Badr was not without its effect in this way. Consequently, it was seldom that those who lived in the dwellings adjoining the mosque could eat their fill at any meal. The Prophet used to say, "The food of one is enough for two, the food of two enough for four, and the food of four enough for eight." Just as he loved sweet scents and fragrance in general, so also he was exceedingly sensitive to the slightest unpleasantness of odour, especially in the breath, in himself and in others. Aisha said that the first thing he would do on entering the house was to take up his toothstick, which was made of green palm wood. When he was on a journey, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud could well be trusted to have one always in readiness for him. The companions followed his example in the use of the toothstick and also in the rinsing of the mouth after every meal. Hunger made no difference to his extreme sensitivity, which he did not always expect others to share. There were certain kinds of food which the law allowed and which he encouraged his companions to eat but would not eat himself, such as the large lizards which were not to be found in Mecca but which were common in Yathrib and elsewhere. Sometimes he would refuse a dish more out of consideration for others than himself. Once a stew was brought to him as a gift from one of the helpers, but just as he was about to take some of it, he noticed that it had a strong smell of garlic and withdrew his hand. Those who were with him immediately did the same. "What is amiss?" he said to them. "Thou withdrewest thy hand," they said, "so we have withdrawn ours." "Eat in the name of God," he said. "I hold intimate converse with one whom ye converse not with." They knew he was referring to the angel. On that occasion, the dish had been prepared and must not be wasted. He nonetheless discouraged them in general from eating food that was over-flavoured with garlic or onions, especially before going to the mosque. An important secondary result of Badr and of the expeditions which preceded it was that Juhayla and other neighbouring Red Sea tribes were now firmly allied with Medina. This meant that the coastal road to Syria was virtually barred to the Meccan caravans. The Meccans felt keenly the loss of their Red Sea caravan route. One of the disadvantages of the only alternative was that in the plain of Najd the wells were relatively far apart. But now that the summer months were drawing to a close, the journey could easily be managed by adding to the number of water-carrying camels. And they decided to send a rich caravan to Iraq, consisting mainly of bars of silver and silver vessels, worth about 100,000 dirhams. It was to be under the leadership of Safwan. Some of the Jews of Medina had secret information about the caravan, and one of the helpers happened to hear them discussing it. The Prophet knew that Zayd had gifts of leadership, and he now sent him, at the head of 100 horse, to waylay the caravan near Karada, which was one of the chief watering places along the route. The relatively small, and therefore more manageable, force made it possible for Zayd to realize all the essentials of an effective ambush. Their sudden, ferocious, and unexpected onslaught put to flight Safwan and his fellows, while Zayd and his men returned to Medina in triumph, having become themselves the escort of all the Meccan transport camels, with their rich loads of silver and other merchandise, and a few captives. In Mecca, the disaster of Karada intensified and quickened the preparations which had been in progress ever since Badr for an irresistible attack on Medina. In the last days of the month of the anniversary of Badr, a sealed letter was brought to the Prophet by a horseman who had ridden from Mecca to Medina in 3 days. It was from his uncle, Abbas, warning him that an army of 3,000 men was on the point of marching out against Medina. 700 of the men were mailed, and there was a troop of horse 200 strong. The camels were as many as the men, not counting the transport camels, and those which carried howdahs for the women. By the time the letter arrived, Quraysh had already set out. Abu Sufyan, the commander-in-chief, took with him Hint, and also a second wife. Safwan likewise brought 2 wives, other chiefs 1 only. Jubair, the son of Mut'im, remained in Mecca. But he sent out with the army an Abyssinian slave of his named Washi, who was, like many of his countrymen, an expert at throwing the javelin. Washi had seldom been known to miss his mark. And Jubair said to him, "If thou slayest Hamza, Muhammad's uncle, in revenge for mine, thou art a free man." Hind came to know of this, and during their halts, whenever she passed Washi in the camp, or saw him passing by, she would say to him, "Go to it, thou father of darkness, slake and then gloat." She had already made it clear to him that she also, as well as his master, had a thirst to be slaked, and a reward for the slaker. The emigrants and helpers still had a week before the enemy could be upon them. But within that time, room had to be made inside the walls of Medina for all those who lived in the outlying parts of the oasis, together with their animals. This was done, and not one horse, camel, cow, sheep, or goat was left outside the walls. It remained to be seen what the Meccan plan of action was. News came that they were taking the western route near the coast. In due course, they turned inland and made a brief halt about 5 miles west of Medina. Then they marched northeast for a few miles and camped on a strip of cultivated land in the plain below Mount Uhud, which overlooks Medina from the north. The Prophet sent out scouts, who returned the next morning with the information that the numbers of the enemy were indeed as the letter had stated. His first thought was not to go out from the city, but to stand a siege within its walls. He nonetheless wished to have his opinion confirmed by others, for it was by no means a conviction, so he held a consultation as to whether they should march out or not. Ibn Ubay was the first to speak. "Our city," he said, "is a virgin that hath never been violated against us. Never without severe losses have we gone out from her to attack an enemy, and none have entered her against us, but it is they who have suffered the losses. Therefore let them be, O Messenger of God. Wretched will be their plight so long as they stay. And when they will return dejected and frustrated in purpose, with no good gained." A large number of the older companions, of both the emigrants and helpers, inclined to the opinion of Ibn Ubay. So the Prophet said, "Stay in Medina and put the women and children in the fortresses." Only when he had spoken thus did it become apparent that most of the younger men were burning with eagerness to march out against the enemy. "O Messenger of God," said one of them, "lead us forth against the enemy. Let them not think we fear them, or that we are too weak for them." These words were met with a murmur of approval from different parts of the assembly, and others said much the same, with the added argument that their inactivity would only serve to embolden Quraysh against them in the future, not to speak of the tribes of Najd. Hamza and Sa'd ibn Ubadah, and others of the more experienced, now began to incline towards this view, and since it was now clear, not only from the words that were spoken, but from the general approval with which they were received, that the majority were against remaining behind the city walls, the Prophet decided to attack. At noon they assembled for the Friday prayer, and the theme of his sermon was the holy war, and all that it demands of earnestness and effort. And he said that victory would be theirs if they remained steadfast. Then he bade them make ready to meet the enemy. The Prophet took Abu Bakr and Umar with him into his house, and they helped him to dress for battle. When the Prophet came out, he had wound his turban about his helmet and donned his breastplate, under which he wore a coat of mail, belted with a leather sword belt. He had girt on his sword and slung his shield across his back. He mounted his horse, Sakub, and asked for his bow, which he hung over his shoulder, taking in his hand a spear. No other man was mounted. 2 men marched in front of him, and there were men on either side. In all, they were about 1,000 strong. The sun was already setting when they reached Sheikhain, about halfway between Medina and Uhud, where they camped for the night. The Prophet gave instructions that the army should be ready to move off shortly before dawn. But Ibn Ubay was in consultation with some of his nearest followers during the night, and when it was time to raise camp, he turned back to Medina with 300 of the hypocrites and doubters, to the great shame of his son Abdullah, who remained with the army. Ibn Ubay did not even speak to the Prophet, and when questioned by some of the helpers, he said, "He hath disobeyed me, and obeyed the striplings and men of no judgment. I see not why we should lose our lives in this ill-chosen spot." Another Abdullah, the father of Jabir, went after them and called out, "I adjure you by God not to desert your people and your Prophet in the very presence of the enemy." But they only answered, If we knew that ye would be fighting, we would not leave you. But we do not think there will be a battle. Enemies of God, he retorted. God will avail his prophet beyond any need of you. Reduced now to 700, the army advanced for a short distance towards the enemy, and then, still under cover of the darkness, they moved to their right and made their way across a volcanic tract until they came to the southeasterly end of the Gorge of Uhud. Turning again, they advanced northwest up the gorge until, in the half-light of dawn, they saw the Meccan camp ahead of them, a little to their left and a little below them. They marched on until they were directly between the enemy and Uhud. Having now reached his objective, which was to have the slope of the ground in his favour, the prophet halted them and dismounted. Bilal made the call to the morning prayer, and they moved into lines with their backs to the mountain. This was also their formation for battle, since the enemy were now between them and Mecca. Having led the prayer, the prophet turned and exhorted them, saying, Verily this day ye are at a station that is rich in reward and rich in treasure, for him who is mindful of what he is about, and who devoteth his soul thereunto, in patience and certainty and earnestness and effort. The prophet now chose his best archers. Of these he attached to himself Zayd, Sa'd, his cousin of Zuhra, and Sa'ib, the son of Uthman ibn Mas'un, amongst others. But he told 50 of them to take up their position on a rise a little to the left of his main force. He put over them Abdullah ibn Jubair, a man of Aus, and gave them their orders, saying, Keep their cavalry from us with your arrows. Let them not come upon us from our rear. Be the tide of battle for us or against us. Stay at this post. If ye see us plundering the enemy, seek not to have a share in it. And if ye see us being slain, come not to our aid. The sun was now up, and Quraysh were already in line, with 100 horse on either wing, commanded on the right by Khalid, son of Walid, and on the left by Ikrimah, son of Abu Jahl. From the centre, Abu Sufyan gave the order to advance. When the two armies were almost joined, the Prophet's archers shot a volley of arrows into Khalid's cavalry, and the neighing of horses drowned the women's voices and their drums. Hind, a large woman of imposing appearance, was in the midst of the men, urging them on to fight, and she narrowly escaped being cut down by Abu Dujana, who thought she was a man. His sword was raised above her head when she shrieked, and, realizing that she was a woman, he turned against the men at her side. She now joined the other wives and mothers in the rear, where the slaves had been put to guard the camp. And as she retreated, Washi, the Abyssinian, was making his way forward. Unlike the rest of those on the field, he was concerned with one man only, and unlike them, his blood was cold. Hamza was unmistakable for his unusually powerful stature, for his manner of fighting, and for his ostrich plume. Washi saw him from a distance, and, while keeping to the edge of the fray, he was able to reach a point of relative safety that was nonetheless close enough for a javelinier to strike. Hamza was now face to face with the last of the standard-bearers of Abd ad-Dar, and as he lifted his sword to strike, he momentarily laid open a chink in his armour. Washi was quick to see his chance, and poising his javelin, he launched it with perfect aim. Hamza staggered a few paces forward, having already killed his man, and fell to the ground in the throes of death. Washi waited until his body stopped moving, and then went and drew out his javelin and returned with all speed to the camp. As he himself said, I had done all I had come to do, and I only killed him for the sake of my freedom. The death of Hamza made little difference to the sense of defeat which was beginning to spread through the Meccan army. Although Hamza's ostrich feather was no longer to be seen, Abu Dujana, Zubair, and others of the emigrants and helpers fought like incarnations of the Muslim battle cry that day, Amit, Amit, which means kill, kill. It seemed that none could resist them. Ali's white plume, Abu Dujana's red turban, the bright yellow turban of Zubair, and the green turban of Hubab were like flags of victory which gave strength to the ranks behind them. The battle had gradually moved down the slope away from the Prophet as the Meccans were driven back towards their camp. He could no longer discern in any detail what was happening, though he could see that so far his men were winning the day. At one point, the enemy lines were broken altogether. The way to their camp was thus laid open, and there was a surge forward of would-be plunderers. Now the 50 chosen archers were at some distance to the left of the Prophet. They could see the first lines, and the sight of their fellows about to enrich themselves, as they thought, with enemy spoils, was too much for most of them. In vain their commander, Abdullah ibn Jubair, reminded them of the Prophet's order not to leave their post on any account. They replied that the Prophet had not meant them to stay there forever. The battle was now finished, they said, and the disbelievers routed. About 40 of them sped down the slope in the direction of the camp, leaving Abdullah at the head of a staunch but fatally depleted nucleus of bowmen. So far, the Meccan cavalry had been of no avail. In the centre, the two armies were so interwoven that a charge of horse would have endangered their own men as well as their enemies, and they could not reach the rear of the Muslim army without first exposing themselves to the shafts of the archers over a long stretch of ground. But Khalid saw what now had happened, and realizing that his moment had come, he led his men at full gallop for the post where the archers were stationed. Abdullah and his men vainly tried to head them off with their arrows. Then they threw down their bows and fought to the death with sword and spear. Not one of the faithful 10 was left alive. And wheeling round, Khalid led his men into the rear of their enemy's main force. Ikrimah followed his example, and the Meccan horsemen made much havoc in the unguarded ranks of the believers. Ali and his companions now turned to face the new danger, and some of the idolaters who had been put to flight rallied and came back into the fray. The tide of battle had suddenly changed, and the Quraysh war cry, "O Uzza, O Hubal," was taken up again all over the field. Many of the Muslims in the rear, who had escaped being cut down by the horsemen, now lost heart and fled towards the mountain, where they knew they could find refuge. The Prophet called to them to return, but their ears were closed to his voice, nor were their minds open to any thought but flight. The majority of the Muslims fought on, but the initial impetus was now lost, and the weight of numbers told against them. They were driven back, step by step, and the whole battle moved towards Uhud, in the direction of the Prophet. He and his companions shot volley after volley of arrows into the enemy, and their group was increased by others from the main force whose chief thought, when the day turned against them, had been the safety of the Prophet. The enemy gradually began to gain the ground they had lost. In the little group round the Prophet, the supply of arrows would soon be finished, and in any case it seemed that the time for archery was running out. If the enemy continued to advance, every sword would soon have to be unsheathed for a final hand-to-hand conflict, with an average of 4 pagans against every believer. Then suddenly a single horseman came in from the side and made straight for where the Prophet was standing. "Where is Muhammad?" he shouted. "May I not survive if he survive?" It was Ibn Kamiyah, a man of one of the outskirt clans of Quraysh, who had already made much slaughter among the Muslims. With a quick glance at the group, his sharp eye recognized his intended victim, and urging on his horse, he brought down his sword in a blow which he was sure no helmet could resist. But Talha, who was standing next to the Prophet, threw himself in the direction of the sword and was somehow able to deflect the blow a little, at the expense of losing the use of the fingers of one of his hands for the rest of his life. The blade narrowly missed the crown of the Prophet's helmet and glanced off the side of it, grazing his temple, driving 2 of the helmet rings into his cheek, and finally, with its force somewhat spent, striking his doubly mailed shoulder. The shock against the side of his head momentarily stunned him, and he fell to the ground, whereupon his assailant withdrew as quickly as he had come. A voice, perhaps that of Ibn Kamiyah himself, was heard to shout, "Muhammad is slain!" The cry was taken up all over the field, interspersed with glorifications of Al-Uzza and Hubal. The cliffs of Uhud resounded, and the Muslims who had fled were overcome with self-reproach and sorrow, while many of those who were still fighting in the plain lost heart and withdrew from the strife as best they might. As to the believers who now sought refuge on the higher ground above the plain, withdrawal was made easier for them, because most of the enemy felt that the battle was now over, and they too slackened their efforts. The dead had not yet been counted, but it was evident that they had amply avenged those who had died at Badr. And now, by killing the man who had been the sole cause of all the strife, they had surely put an end to the new religion and virtually re-established the old order of things. The sudden relaxing of effort on the part of Quraysh was nowhere more apparent than amongst those who had half-surrounded the little group of some 20 men who were acting as a bodyguard to the Prophet. It had become clear to the Meccans that these were men who would never be taken prisoner, and who in fighting to the death would certainly deal death to others. So their better course, now that their main purpose had been achieved, was to live and let live, and to celebrate their victory. The Prophet had almost immediately recovered consciousness, and when the enemy had withdrawn, he rose to his feet, and motioning to his companions to follow him, he led them towards the entrance of a glen, which seemed to offer the easiest ascent to a point of safety from which they could watch over the movement of the enemy. As the small party moved up the glen, they were seen by some of those who had already taken refuge on Uhud, and they came down to meet them. Ka'b ibn Malik was ahead of the others, and he was surprised to see a man whose stature and bearing were exactly like those of the Prophet, albeit that his gait was slower. Then, as he drew near, Ka'b saw the incomparable and unmistakable brightness of the eyes through the eye-holes of the visor, and he turned and shouted to those behind him, "O Muslims, be of good cheer! This is the Messenger of God!" The Prophet motioned him to be silent, and he did not shout the good news again, but it spread from mouth to mouth, and men came hurrying to reassure themselves that it was true. So great was the rejoicing that it was as if the defeat had suddenly been changed into victory. When the Prophet and his companions reached the top of the glen, Ali went to fill his shield with water from a cavity in the rocks. He held it out to the Prophet, but the odour of its stagnancy repelled him, and he could not bring himself to drink of it, despite his thirst, though he used some of it to wash the blood from his face. Then, since they were still too easily accessible from the plain, he gave the word to move onwards to higher ground, and he tried to raise himself onto a ledge of rock from which further ascent could be made. But he was too weak for the effort, so Talha crouched below the ledge with great violence to his wounds, and taking the Prophet on his back, he raised him to the necessary height. The Prophet said of him that day, "He that would behold a martyr walking the face of the earth, let him look on Talha, the son of Ubayd Allah." By the time they had found a place which could serve as a temporary camp, the sun had reached its zenith, and they prayed the noon prayer. The Prophet, who led it, remained seated throughout, and everyone followed his example. Then they lay down to rest, and many of them slept a deep and refreshing sleep, while a relay of watchmen kept watch from a point of vantage overlooking the plain. Quraysh were now busy about their dead and their wounded. The losses had not been great. There were only 22 killed out of 3,000. Then they counted the losses of the enemy and found about 65 dead, many of whom they did not know. In vain they searched for the body of Muhammad, and while they were doing so, Washi went back to the body of Hamza, ripped open his belly, cut out his liver, and brought it to Hind. "What shall be mine for slaying the slayer of thy father?" he said. "All my share of the spoils," was her answer. "This is Hamza's liver," he said, and she took it from him and bit away a piece of it, chewed it, swallowed a morsel in fulfillment of her vow, and spat out the rest. "Show me where he is," she said. And when they reached the body, she cut off his nose and ears and other parts of his flesh. Then she took off her necklaces and pendants and anklets and gave them to Washi, telling the women who were with her to mutilate others of the dead. They all made for themselves ornaments of vengeance with what they cut from the bodies of the Muslims, and Hind mounted upon a rock and uttered a chant of triumph. It was now presumed that Ibn Kamiya had been mistaken and that the Prophet was with his army somewhere on the high ground above the plain. But the battle was over. There could be no question of attacking the mountain, and the slaves had already been told to strike camp. So when they had buried their own dead and taken their fill of revenge on the enemy dead, they loaded the armour and whatever else they had stripped from them onto their camels and prepared to set off. But before they did so, Abu Sufyan mounted his chestnut mare and rode to the foot of the mountain, to the point nearest where the Prophet and his companions had been stationed, and shouted at the top of his voice, "War goeth by turns, and this is a day for a day. Exalt thyself, O Hubal, make prevail thy religion." The Prophet told Umar to go and answer him, saying, "God is all highest, supreme in majesty. We are not equal. Our slain are in paradise, yours are in the fire." So Umar went to the edge of the precipice below which Abu Sufyan was standing, and answered him as the Prophet had said. Whereupon Abu Sufyan called up to Umar, having recognized his voice, "I adjure thee, Umar, by God, have we slain Muhammad?" "No, by God," said Umar, "but he is even now listening to what thou sayest. I take thy word for it as truer than the word of Ibn Kamiya," said Abu Sufyan. Then he said, "Badr, be your meeting place with us next year." Hearing this, the Prophet sent another of his companions to the edge of the cliff to shout his response. "That is a binding tryst between us." Abu Sufyan rode to where his army was waiting for him at the further side of the plain, and they set off towards the south. The Prophet now led his companions down into the plain to bury their dead. When the last grave had been filled, the Prophet called for his horse and mounted it, and they set off down the gorge the way they had come at dawn. When they reached the beginning of the lava tract, he told them to stand in line to give praise and thanksgiving to God, and the men formed two lines facing Mecca with the women behind them, 14 women in all. Then he glorified God and prayed, saying, "O God, I ask of thee thy blessing and thy mercy and thy grace and thine indulgence. O God, I ask of thee the eternal bliss that fadeth not nor passeth away. O God, I ask of thee safety on the day of fear and plenty on the day of destitution." And so they returned to Medina. On his return from fighting at Uhud, Abdullah, the son of Ibn Ubay, had spent part of the night after the battle cauterizing a wound, while his father enlarged on the folly of having gone out to attack the enemy. "By God, it was as if I had seen it all," he said. "What God did for his messenger and the Muslims was good," said his son. But Ibn Ubay was not open to argument. "If the slain had been with us, they would not have been slain," he insisted. Nor had he been silent during his son's recent absence from Medina with the rest of the fighters. Neither had the Jews refrained from affirming, with more conviction than ever, "Muhammad is nothing but a seeker of kingship. No prophet hath ever met with such reverse. He was smitten in his own body, as well as in his companions." Much of what had been said by both Jews and hypocrites was repeated to Umar. He immediately went to the Prophet and asked his permission to kill those who were responsible but the prophet forbade him to do so. God will make prevail his religion, he said, and he will empower his prophet. Then he said, O son of Khattab, verily Quraysh shall not gain from us the like of that day again, and we shall greet the corner. He meant that they would enter Mecca and kiss the black stone. Although Umar's hands were tied, Ibn Ubay did not escape altogether unscathed. He had taken to occupying a place of honour in the mosque at the Friday prayer, and no one had thought to deny him this on account of his standing in Medina. When the Prophet mounted the pulpit to preach, he would rise and say, O people, this is the Messenger of God. May God, through him, be bountiful to you and give you strength. Help ye him, therefore, and honour him, and hear him, and obey him. Then he would be seated again. But when he rose to speak as usual on the day after their return, the first Friday since Uhud, those of the helpers who were nearest him seized him on both sides, saying, Sit, thou enemy of God! Thou art not worthy to hold forth, having done what thou didst. Whereupon he left the congregation, threading his way through the densely seated men. One of the helpers, who met him at the door of the mosque, said to him, Return and let the Messenger of God ask forgiveness for thee. But he said, By God, I want not that he should ask forgiveness for me. Later that year, the Prophet's cousin, Abu Salama, died of a wound from Uhud, which had closed too soon and broken out afresh. The Prophet was with him at the end and prayed for him as he was breathing his last. And it was the Prophet who closed his eyes when he was dead. Abu Salama and his wife had been a most devoted couple, and she had wanted him to make a pact with her that if one of them died, the other would not marry again. But he told her that if he died first, she should marry again. And he prayed, God grant Salama, after me a man who is better than me, one who will cause her no sadness and no hurt. 4 months after his death, the Prophet came and asked for her hand in marriage. She replied that she feared she was not a suitable match for him. I am a woman whose best time hath gone, she said, and I am the mother of orphans. What is more, I have a nature of exceeding jealousy, and thou, O Messenger of God, hast already more than one wife. He answered, As to age, I am older than thou. As to thy jealousy, I will pray God to take it from thee. As to thine orphan children, God and his messenger will care for them. And so they were married. A year of peace passed, and the time was drawing near for the second encounter at Badr, in accordance with Abu Sufyan's parting challenge after Uhud, a challenge which the Prophet had accepted. But it was a year of drought, and Abu Sufyan saw that there would not be a blade of greenery for their camels and horses to eat on the way. All the fodder for the expedition would have to be brought with them from Mecca, and their stores were already depleted. But he shrank from the dishonour of breaking the tryst, which he had himself proposed. It was desirable that Muhammad should be the one to break it, but reports had come from Yathrib that he was already making preparations to set out. Could he be induced to change his mind? Abu Sufyan went into consultation with Suhail and one or two other leaders of Quraysh, and they formed a plan. There happened to be in Mecca at that time a friend of Suhail's named Nu'aym, one of the leading men of the Bani Ashja, a clan of Khatafan. They felt they could trust him, and since he was not of Quraysh, he could pose as a neutral and objective onlooker. They offered him 20 camels if he could induce the Muslims to renounce their project of marching out to Badr. Nu'aym agreed and set out at once for the oasis, where he drew an alarming picture of the forces which Abu Sufyan was preparing to lead out to Badr. He spoke to all the different sections of the community, emigrants, helpers, Jews, and hypocrites, and he would close his assessment of the danger with the urgent counsel, Therefore stay here and go not out against them. By God, I do not think a single one of you will escape with his life. The Jews and the hypocrites were glad at the news of Meccan preparations for war, and they helped to spread the tidings throughout the city. Nor did Nu'aym fail to make an impression on the Muslims themselves, many of whom were inclined to think that it would indeed be most unwise to go out to Badr. News of this attitude reached the Prophet, and he began to fear that no one would go out with him. But Abu Bakr and Umar urged him on no account to break his tryst with Quraysh. God will support his religion, they said, and he will give strength to his messenger. I will go forth, said the Prophet, even if I go alone. These few words cost Nu'aym his camels, making vain all his efforts, just when he was beginning to think that he had succeeded. But despite himself, he was impressed by the total failure of his mission. Some power was at work in Medina, which was altogether beyond his influence and beyond his experience, and the seeds of Islam were sown in his heart. The Prophet set out as originally planned, with 1,500 men on camels and 10 horsemen. Many of them took merchandise with them, intending to trade at the fair of Badr. Meantime, Abu Sufyan had said to Quraysh, Let us go out and spend one night or two nights on the road, and then return. If Muhammad go not out, he will hear that we set forth, and that we then returned, because he came not out to meet us. This will be counted against him and in our favour. But as it happened, the Prophet and his companions spent 8 days at the fair of Badr, and those who attended it reported the news far and wide, that Quraysh had broken their word, but that Muhammad and his followers had kept theirs and had come to fight Quraysh as they had promised. When the news reached Mecca of the great moral victory of their enemy and of their own moral defeat in the eyes of Arabia, Safwan and others bitterly upbraided Abu Sufyan for ever having proposed the second encounter at Badr. But this mortification nonetheless served to intensify their preparations for the final and lasting revenge which they were planning to inflict on the founder and followers of the new religion. There was another month of peace in Medina, and then, at the head of 1,000 men, the Prophet made a rapid northward march of about 500 miles to the edge of Dumat al-Jandal, an oasis on the borders of Syria which had become infested with marauders, mostly from the Bani Kalb. They had more than once plundered provisions of oil and flour and other goods which were on their way to Medina. There was also reason to suppose that they had entered into some agreement with Quraysh, which meant that they would close in from the north when the day came for a general onslaught upon Islam. The Prophet and his companions had that day continually in mind, and though the immediate result of the expedition was no more than the scattering of the marauders and the capture of their flocks and herds which were grazing on the southern pastures of the oasis, it had also the desired effect of impressing the northern tribes in general with a sense of the presence of a new and rapidly increasing power in Arabia. Gone were the years of civil discord which had made Yathrib so vulnerable to outside attack. That discord had been replaced by a closely united, expansive strength which could strike far and wide with amazing speed, and which was all the more to be feared because it knew that attack was the surest means of defence. Such was the outward impression. But for those who were capable of approaching nearer, the strength was seen to be even greater than it appeared, for it was based on a unity that was itself a miracle. The revelation had told the Prophet, If thou hadst spent all that is in the earth, thou couldst not have united their hearts. But God hath united their hearts. The presence of the Prophet was nonetheless one of the great means of realizing this unitedness. Providentially, the attraction of that presence had been made so powerful that no man of normal goodwill could resist it. Not one of you hath faith, until I am dearer to him than his son and his father and all men together. But this utterance of the Prophet was not so much a demand as a confirmation of the rightness of a love that had already been given, a love which found its expression so often in the words, "May my father and my mother be thy ransom."